Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
You're listening to Working, the show about what people do all day. I'm your host, Jordan Weissman. On this week's episode, I talk with Helena Newman, who is the co-head of Impressionist and Modern Art at Sotheby's, the 274-year-old auction house. A simple way to think about her job is that she's the art auctioneer who recently sold a $157 million masterpiece by Modigliani. I spoke with Helena the day after that sale about how she pulls that kind of auction together, and I just want to take a moment to set the scene for you. The Sotheby's offices are a bit like a library of art, with these shelves of paintings filed one after another in storage and desks kind of tucked around them. I sat down with Helena in a room off to the side that had these religious portraits by old masters just kind of strewn all over the place. And I swear to God, I was terrified that I was going to kick over a $1 million Madonna and Child. I actually don't know that it was $1 million, but I just kind of had it rolling in my head that I might cause seven figures of damage if I wasn't careful or spilled my water. But anyway, it was a lovely room, and it had these huge light-filled windows that unfortunately also let in the occasional siren from the hospital next door. So I apologize if you hear a little bit of street noise during this interview. Other than that, I hope you enjoy. What's your name and what do you do?
I'm Helena Newman, and I work at Sotheby's, the international auction house. I'm chairman of Sotheby's in Europe. I'm an auctioneer, and I co-head the Impressionist and Modern Art Department worldwide.
That's a very capacious job description.
Yes.
But what does that even begin to entail? If you had to sum it up in two sentences...
Well,
can it be summed up in two sentences?
I can sum it up in two words: sourcing, selling.
Okay, let's start with sourcing. What's sourcing?
So sourcing is hunting the world over for great works of art that we can bring to market. And that's a huge part of my job, actually, is looking for Impressionist and Modern art in private collections, mainly discussing with collectors the value, the market opportunities, negotiating the bringing of those works to market, either at auction or for private sale.
And selling sounds fairly straightforward?
Yeah, and the selling, well, it's certainly not straightforward when you're dealing with the kind of price levels that we are working in, but it's marketing the paintings we've sourced to our global audience, Asia, US, Europe, and beyond, and advising buyers, consulting with buyers, bringing the works around the world in the exhibition tours, and everything culminating with the auction, as we had here last night at Sotheby's.
And last night you sold, I believe, the most expensive painting that Sotheby's has ever auctioned.
That's right. It was Modigliani's Nu Coucher from 1917, the big monumental, splendid reclining nude by Amadeo Modigliani. It made a world, made it record price for any work of art sold at Sotheby's at auction, $157.2 million.
And how are y'all feeling about that right now?
Well, I mean, it was, for me personally, it was a really historic moment. I mean, it was a real highlight of my career as an auctioneer and in terms of my, you know, role in the Impressionist and Modern Art fields. It was, you know, it's a very, very extraordinary price.
So we're going to come back to the specifics of that auction in a bit, but I want to start just by asking how you got to Sotheby's. How long have you even been here?
Oh, well, I've been here. It's my 30th year now.
30?
So yes, yes. But Sotheby's is the only place I've ever worked, actually. I went straight from university to Sotheby's as a trainee, and I worked my way up in different areas of expertise, but very quickly homing in on my favorite, which is Impressionist and modern art. So everything from, say, Claude Monet through to Picasso of the 1960s. So it's about 100 years of Western art that I'm covering.
And were you an art student in school? Or
I actually studied French and German literature and language at Oxford. So I was, in a way, I was doing a kind of parallel expertise in a way, because when I came to take on art history, I'd already been doing a lot of work on analyzing literature and poetry from a similar period as the one I'm now covering in the art world.
And so what made you decide to join Sotheby's in the first place?
Well, just a, you know, passion for art and interest and desire to get more into it. And, you know, the opportunity came up to apply to Sotheby's, and I was really excited about the kind of mix of commercial and art, that kind of unique, which is still what actually gets me out of bed in the morning every day. It's that kind of buzz around access to the art and the commercial side, which is just endlessly enthralling.
That's interesting to me, because some people, I think, really like to divide off the commercial from the art itself. And that's what actually gets you, that's
sure,
what gets you revved up.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think if you don't want the whole commercial side, then definitely this wouldn't be the place to be. But if you like the kind of buzz of deal making and the energy around the selling and the conversations with the collectors, and, you know, if you sort of thrive on being right at the very core of the international art market, which is what Sotheby's is. It's actually the sort of, it's leading and driving the art market in terms of visibility and actually setting the tone. It's very exciting.
So how do you find the art?
And, well, how do I find it? Well, after many, many years, I have a pretty good idea of where a lot of it is, as do my colleagues from all over the world. We're a big network at Sotheby's, with offices in, you know, 80 or 90 locations worldwide. So each of my colleagues in turn has relationships with collectors, and when an opportunity comes up, I jump on the plane and go there to see it.
So it's almost like an intelligence service type thing in a way?
Well, we thrive off what we know, both in terms of our expertise around the art and our knowledge of the where it is. And that is how we build our relationships and how we're able, in the end, to marry up sellers and buyers.
So it seems like that's half the trick in the art world, is actually knowing who owns the paintings and where to find them.
I mean, I think that a lot of the great works are in private collections, and many of those collectors we know at Sotheby's because we've been servicing them for years, helping them build their collections. They've been coming to the auctions. We know them. We've been advising, valuing, and so that's how we have that access.
And is it typically they're coming to you saying, "I think, you know, I've had this Modigliani or this Picasso sitting in my living room for 15 years now, and I think it's time to unload it"? Or are you going to them and saying, "I think you have an opportunity here"?
Well, look, we have a mixture of both. There's what we call the reactive, you know, from time to time, there will be that exciting mystery call that, you know, you haven't had before, and something new comes up on the horizon you don't know. But invariably, it's more a dialogue that we know where the works are, and then we might actually start the conversation and say, right now there's this hunger for great masterpieces. There's actually, you know, a great depth of global buyers looking for good things. So maybe now is a good time to discuss it. And that's how the conversation might initiate.
And so take me through that process. Do you just call someone up one day and say, do you just send them? How does that work?
well, I might call them up, or we might go and visit them, and we might discuss it better one-to-one, actually, for these high-value works. I spend a lot of my time traveling. I mean, I'm usually on a plane. Well, I'm based in London. I'm here in New York, obviously, for the auctions this week. But when I'm back in London, I'm usually spending 1 or 2 days a week traveling around, usually on the continent in Europe, going to Switzerland and France and Germany and Italy, and in discussions with collectors about opportunities in the market.
So it starts, I take it, with sort of an informal conversation. Does then that turn into you showing up with a bunch of other specialists and a slide deck presentation, or how do you then kind of push that process forward?
Well, absolutely. But I think that each one is different on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, sometimes there'll be a formal contest to win a collection. You see that quite a lot in America, actually, where very often estates are managed by lawyers and executors, and so they will have a very sort of formal fiduciary process to choose who is going to handle the sale. And then there will indeed be a presentation with materials and marketing and data and the full works, as you might call it, like a sort of not quite a talent contest, but pitching to win a major deal. And, you know, that's the sort of one extreme. And then I think, you know, particularly in Europe, it tends to be a bit more informal. So, you know, it's more about planting the seed of an idea and then developing that. And yes, it's generally more informal. It doesn't mean it's not as significant a decision, but the process is probably achieved in a less structured way.
When you're talking to someone about whether or not it's time to sell their art, what do they usually want to know? What are you trying to communicate to them?
Well, look, first of all, some people may already have made the decision to sell, because they're what we call the three Ds: death, debt, and divorce, which are very often the sort of core triggers for a decision to sell. But in the fourth D, the so-called discretionary, which is, you know, I don't need to, but I would if it's a good idea. I think that's the one you're thinking about. It's more that people are considering, you know, is this a good time? Is the context right? Is the market good? Could I get a good price? You know, will it be a decision that I will live happily with? And have I got a reason to use that money to buy something else I prefer, you know, or, you know, invest in some project? So, you know, each person's looking at a different set of criteria when they're making their decision, and we work through that together. That's part of the conversation.
And I assume you have a big staff you're kind of commanding over during this whole process?
Oh, well, hardly commanding, but no, we do have a great, great team at Sotheby's. It's really great, actually. And it's very, you know, it's international, it's diverse in its reach, deep in its expertise. And, you know, we love working together. And actually that sort of trust we have as a team is key to getting it done, because, you know, we're dealing with a very fast-moving, competitive world, you know, high stakes. And, the prices are very high right now. And so that ability to move in a sort of nimble, seamless way across continents, across time zones, is crucial to our success.
So the people you have working for you, are they mostly focused on market analysis? Are they sort of financial analysts, or are they art experts? Who's on your team?
No. Mainly yeah. Art experts, specialists, valuers, people with relationships with buyers. This similar to what I'm doing. I mean, I certainly don't do it alone. I have a team. We work in a team. We make the take, because actually a lot of it is to do with judgment calls on value. And that's not something you can look up in a book or research in a database alone. It's actually a judgment calls on how a picture will appeal in the market, who's going to like it, how much they'll like it, who will buy it, and how much will they pay. And those kind of judgments we make together, and we discuss it, and everybody has their instincts and their kind of their own bank of information and knowledge that they've built up. And so it's very helpful, actually, to share that dialogue and decision making as we make major calls on pricing, as we build an auction.
So how do you make that judgment?
Well, We make that judgment based on a combination of the visual, the art itself, how it is, how it appeals, the quality, the strength of the work, the success of the work as a work of art. Do you look at it and does it have that wow factor that you just can't take your eyes from? You know, like the Modigliani had, you know, that amazing, you know, socket to you in the eyes masterpiece. And all the time we're also bringing into our judgment our bank of knowledge of other works, because it's, in a way, it is a hierarchical judgment. It's how does this compare? How do you rank it in a way? How, you know, which do you prefer? Because that also is how our collectors will look at the works. You know, do they love it, or whether they rather wait for something else? So there's a lot of that kind of discussion of how you cite something in terms of quality. How successful is the work of art? That judgment, and then there's the pricing and the precedent and our knowledge of the market, who's out there and who's looking for what.
So I'm trying to picture this. Is there a meeting at some point where you're sitting around with a bunch of spreadsheets and what similar works have gone through before and your other colleagues here, and just where you kind of sit and hash it out? Or is it, and that's how it actually...
They're what we call like a pricing meeting, and there's a, or valuation meeting, or whatever we like to call it. But absolutely, we... You know, people bring their, they bring what, you know, so say we're all out on the road for a week and everyone's, one person's been in Milan and someone else had to fly to New York overnight, and then someone went to Geneva and I was in Paris, and then we regroup and everybody brings what they've seen, and then we discuss it. And, you know, sometimes we have the ability to be looking firsthand at the works because they've already arrived in the building, but sometimes we're working from images, good images or as good as we can get, and then that's when we have that really in depth, very often more than one conversation, really on the research, on the understanding the work of art, and then trying to come to the commercial judgment on how it should be priced.
And at what point in this process are you actually coming to that judgment? Is it once the client has said, okay, I'm definitely going to sell? Is it when you're still trying to convince them? Is it sort of all the...
Well, I mean, it starts at the beginning of the process, from the beginning. But obviously, you know, it's also an evolving market. I mean, there is no static point. I mean, like, we have a whole lot of new points now after the sale last night. We have new data, if you like to call it that way. So it's a constantly evolving situation in terms of each work and its market appeal and the value. So each time there's a major auction, you've got if you look at what's happened now in New York over the last week, and there's still the rest of this week to come, at the end of it, maybe there'll be $1.5 billion of art would have been traded. And that will give us a whole new set of benchmarks against which we can make new judgments.
And so are you going to be spending the next week sort of regrouping and saying, okay, what does this make us think about the market, and what do we do next?
Absolutely. So then after the sale, there's the kind of debrief, and what does it mean? And so, you know, what does it mean for Picasso? What does it mean for Chagall? What does it mean for Monet? And then in our new conversations, there are a lot of people will be, you know, calling up, wanting to discuss things. How did it go? What does it, you know, what does that say for the market? And so we'll be having those discussions ourselves, and then we'll be communicating it with the wider collectors we're working with, and we'll be building our next sale based on that information, which, believe it or not, is only 5 weeks away. So right on to the next.
How long does it take you to plan out an individual auction?
Well, we have four major auctions a year, two in New York and two in London for Impressionist Modern Contemporary Art, which are sort of main flagship fine art sales, all masters too. And we prepare, it takes about 3 months each sale to prepare. So we're running on a sort of 3 month period of sourcing, gathering the material, preparing for the sale, marketing, sending the works on global tour, and then setting up the exhibition in the sale location, which is a sort of 7 to 10 day view, and then culminating in the auction itself. So it's running in about 4 3-month cycles throughout the year, roughly.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp's software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. Ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
So we talked about finding the art, sourcing it, and we've talked a little bit about selling, but how do you go about marketing a piece once you know it's going to be sold?
Well, look, if you take the Modigliani, that was, you know, an exciting painting to work on. We actually decided to unveil that painting in Hong Kong because of the growth that we've seen in Asia and for Western art, which has been a real huge contributory factor to our market over the last 4 or 5 years. And we took the painting to Asia. We did a worldwide press announcement, but launched in Asia with a live streaming of the actual press call and the unveiling of the painting. And it was hugely successful in terms of impact. And that was followed by the exhibition in Hong Kong at our premises at Sotheby's in Hong Kong. And then the painting came straight to New York, where we've had a 2.5 week view on the amazing, splendid 10th floor gallery space that we have here on York Avenue. I mean, on one day alone, we had 2,200 people come through the building. I mean, it's been a very, very busy schedule. And very often in these sales, we'll have one like major masterpiece, which will be the magnet to draw in our collectors. But in fact, you know, many of them are not coming to spend $150 million. They're coming to look at the whole display that's here. And we have, you know, several hundreds of works here that also benefit from the marketing around the top lots and that we're selling over the course of 2 weeks here.
So this last auction, you had 46 items.
Yes, 43 maybe in the end, yes.
So how much of your personal attention is on the kind of marquee painting, like the Modigliani, and how much of your personal attention is devoted to the other 45?
Oh, no, I'm on all, with my senior team, we're on all 43 lots, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that long a sale, so, and that's 43 important lots with a total value of $316 million, and we absolutely have the bandwidth as a global team to be looking at all of those.
Why do you publish the prices or the estimated prices?
Well, the estimate price is a guideline to our buyers for the kind of price level they need to be thinking at to bid on a lot. And it also reflects conversations we've had with the seller, because the sellers will set a minimum reserve price below which they will not part with the work. And that minimum price cannot exceed the low estimate. So our guideline estimate will have a range from a low to a high, say 10 to 15 or 15 to 20 or 20 to 30. And that guideline will also be pegged to the owner's minimum expectation, which cannot be higher than the low end. So that is actually the he gives some indication to a buyer of the price they need to pay to win the work. Of course, it doesn't indicate at the top end, because with competition, prices can be exceeded and there's no top end at auction, but it does give some indication for the lower end, which can be set at the low estimate or below.
And at what point do you start to get a sense of what the painting might actually sell for during this process? Do you get a sense, is it sort of midway, or do you know? Or
yes, well, I think that we know more and more, and we know less and less. It's very interesting. So we have a very good way of you know, measuring the growth of interest as it builds before a sale. But the thing about auction is you never know. And that is the most incredible thing about the auction mechanism, is that anything can happen in the serum. You know, somebody can miss the call because they get out of range and they can't pick up the mobile, or you can have a surprise and a buyer that you had no idea was going to bid can register half an hour before the sale, and then they're in the room. So actually, it's that is part of what brings the energy and the anticipation and the excitement to the auction, which is why so many people turn up for these big sales, because it is the market in its making at that moment.
You have an auction in the evening. How do you start your day?
Okay, well, in New York, I'm up early because I'm from London. So yesterday I went for a walk in Central Park first thing. So that's always great. I love the park. That helps sort of clear my mind and help, you know, me focus for the day. And then at 9 o'clock, we all meet as a team to go through the sale. And that's what we call our big interest meeting. And there's a large, large team of us. People have come in, flown in from all over the world, from Beijing, from Moscow, from London, from Paris, from Brussels, from Chicago and Hong Kong. And so we're all together and everybody's bringing their information there, what they think they're going to do, how their clients might bid. And that helps me, together with my team, build a picture of how we think it's going to go, and helps us also update our sellers on how things are looking. Some of them may want to actually, you know, give us a bit of flexibility with their minimum price, with their reserve price, because they may say, well, look, actually, if the interest is a bit thin, I may actually lower my reserve. That informs our discussions throughout the day, and we're getting constant updates. So after that 1 hour meeting, I go back onto the exhibition floor, which has still got 2 to 3 hours more of viewing, which is the sort of last hours before we close, to set up for the sale. And, you know, there are people who come back on the last day. Some people arrive for the first time on that day. They've come in from out of town. So that's also still quite important, the last few hours of viewing. So that's always got that sort of energy as people are going around and asking questions, asking for condition reports, asking for advice on the bidding. How far do we think something will go? What will it take to win it? So that's very interesting to gauge the mood. Mm-hmm. So I'm up on the 10th floor. And then I usually like to take a couple of hours break, go back to the hotel and rest, eat something, you know, think about it, psych myself up, you know, prepare. Just you know, take that time out, because it's going to be a long day and I've already been up early anyway. So I did that yesterday. And then by 3 o'clock, it was prep time. So that whole period, 3 till 7, is full on hair, makeup, back to the office, another meeting to go through the whole sale. That took a good hour. And then straight to change and get set up for the sale. So it was actually really quite a fast turnaround yesterday. It was, you know, 4 hours to prepare the end of it.
And what do you need to be prepared for specifically for when you're up there? What is it that you want to make sure you have down pat when you walk up to the podium?
Well, I think that it is, I think there's the technical side, which is the book. The auctioneer has a book, which is basically a list of the 43 lots we're selling, with the minimum price, the bids that have come in, who may be on the telephone, and where there may be interest in the room. So that's the sort of technical aspect. You've got to have an updated book. You've got to know where you're going to start, which increment, which bid you're going to start, where you want to end, what you do in different eventualities. So that's the sort of number preparation. The actual nuts and bolts of running the auction correctly.
And there are people bidding during the auction from all over the world, right? I mean, when you say on the telephone,
yes,
you're
yes.
talking about clients who are actually in Asia or in Europe,
yes.
and who aren't presently there, but they are.
Yes.
And
yes.
Do you know every single person who's on the phone at that moment?
Well, I know my colleagues who are bidding on the phone.
Okay.
And I know quite a few of the clients, and sometimes they'll have a client I don't know, but I have a pretty good sense of who they're bidding for.
And what about the people in the room itself, or how, to what extent do you know exactly who's there at that point?
Yeah, no, I know the room pretty well. Yes. Yeah. I mean, because I've been in the business 30 years, so I know a lot of the people in the room.
So
yeah,
it's just, you just recognize the faces?
Yes,
or
yes,
is it, they
yes.
kind of, there's a briefing beforehand where they say, Mr. Jones is in aisle two.
Oh, yes, I have my briefing, but I do recognize a lot of the faces, but we have a seating plan. So I do actually know, if I had a completely photographic memory, I would have it all off pat, but I do see the seating chart and I know who's sitting where. But a lot of the clients are very familiar to me anyway. So it's not like looking out into a sea of unknown people. On the contrary, it's people many of whom I've worked with actually are sitting out there in the room and now become private advisors and dealers and collectors in their own right.
And is part of your role to sort of have a hunch about who might be bidding at any given
yes.
moment?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think the skill in auctioning is actually, you know, exactly having that hunch, having knowing when to push, knowing when to move on, knowing when that's it, and you bring the hammer down, the pace, and where to look to, how to get that extra bid. I mean, we talked about the technical side of the preparation, but there's the whole, there's obviously the preparation in terms of voice and, physical, just to be warmed up like any performance, warmed up and ready with the energy, but relaxed at the same time. And and then there's the mental. It's actually the complete, utter focus on the delivery of the highest possible price for each lot.
So how do you deliver that when you're up there? What is it that you are doing when you are taking the bids that to sort of coax that from the audience or from the customers?
Well, I mean, I think each auctioneer is true to their own style. So first of all, you've got to be completely authentic in the way you do it. I think you can't look, you've got to be just yourself, but at the same time, some people say it's like conducting an orchestra, that you've got to bring people in at the right time and you've got to, wait just that extra second to get a bid that might otherwise not happen, but then be ready to swiftly move on if the bid's dying down, and use your combination of persuasive authority and charm to get every bid you can.
I've read that sometimes auctioneers will actually start the bidding below even that reserve price, the very low end.
Yes.
How does that fit into the art? What is that of auctioneering? What does that do?
Okay, well, the auctioneer typically starts below to get the bidding going in the room. It's to kind of build a momentum. It's to get, if you just start at the price and call the price and nothing happens, then that's it. So you've got to, in a way, start at a level where you can draw people in, get a bid, get somebody to compete, and create that sense of momentum and energy in the room to first of all, to get your first bid. And then once you've locked in your first bid, to get that competition rolling. And that's part of the technique of running the sale. And you've got to judge where you start, not too low, not too high, how fast, how high to go up. You know, all that kind of level is in the auctioneer's discretion.
So you're hooking people at that point.
Well,
you're fishing.
you're trying to get your first bid. And the audience knows that at that point, when you're below, when you start low, maybe hasn't quite started yet. But that's kind of that is the house style of the auction. You know, you get it going, you start a bit lower, and you see where people come in. It's just the kind of whole psychology of drawing in your first bid.
Is there sort of a rule of thumb that says after a certain amount of time, it's just, you have to bring down the hammer? How do you, it seems like that's a really important choice.
Yes.
So how do you make that decision?
Yeah, but that isn't, you see, there isn't a rule of thumb. You've got to use your judgment, instinct, knowledge of the market, knowledge of the bidders, and sense of timing to make all those decisions in a split second. And, I've been taking auctions for 20 years, so you're also drawing on experience.
So you've been doing auctions for 20 years of your career, you said?
Yes. So I've been an auctioneer for about 20 years, but I've only relatively recently started taking the evening auctions, which are our big flagship sales in London and New York for Impressionist and Modern Art. And I think my first evening auction of Impressionist and Modern Art was in London in June 2016.
And how does that change the nature of your job?
Well, I think it's a total different, it's not totally different, but the gap between the evening sale is a kind of different environment in which to auction. It's very high profile. It's watched by the art market to set a kind of barometer for the health of the market, and it's high value. So there's a lot more at stake, and I think it requires a different kind of style as an auctioneer as well, in the sense that there's more drama, there's more anticipation, there's more inevitable tension in the room because of the prices involved. And so it's very exciting. It's something I love doing. And I find I need to bring to it a sort of level of energy that is appropriate for the sums that are being traded.
Have you actually had to change your presentation style at all?
Well, I think because the stakes are higher, it requires that much more drama. You know, it's a larger room, there are more people, there are more phones, there's more people watching online, thousands of people, I think, watching online. So I think my style has evolved more. I haven't made a major change in style. It's more being a kind of refining and improving my own style to match the level of the occasion.
Do you ever find yourself attached to a particular painting?
Very much so. Very, very much so. I mean, look, I have my own personal taste and passions. Unfortunately, you know, I have rather expensive tastes. It's not like I can afford to buy these and live with them at home. But I enjoy immensely living with the art, and I have the privilege in my office in London, which is also doubles up as one of our private viewing rooms, to hang works of art as they come through our sale rooms as we're preparing for the sales. So, you know, earlier on this year, I had the wonderful 1937 Picasso of Marie-Thérèse hanging in my office, which was incredible. I mean, not for very long, but just those few days, it was rather amazing to be living up close with this great painting and just enjoying the kind of sheer power of Picasso's, handling. It was a great experience. I love that. And then, you know, it comes the auction and it moves on and the painting's sold. And then very often I get to see it in its next collection and the one after that and the one after that, because you often, these pictures are resurfacing in different places around the world. And so it's not like I lose touch with them. They return as old friends in different environments.
Do you ever feel like you're hoping a little bit a particular person will buy a painting, or are there some buyers that you like more than others?
Well, look, you know, I have my certain relationships with buyers I've got to know very well, and others I don't know so well. But, you know, sometimes if you've had long conversations with somebody, you're kind of rooting for them and you're hoping that they're going to get lucky. You know, if you know they've been looking for a particular kind of work for a long time, and then finally here's their moment, and you think, go on, go for it. But in the end, you know, as an auctioneer, my job is to get the highest possible price.
It's been reported that the Modigliani that was sold last night ended up going to what's called a guarantor, or someone who says, before the auction, I'm going to pay X amount. Mm-hmm. How does having that, it's sort of like an insurance policy, right? Having that third party there. Mm-hmm. How does that change the dynamic for you when you're doing your job?
Well, first of all, we don't comment on the identity of the buyer and whether where it landed. But I mean, having an irrevocable bid, I mean, if one's just talking about it more broadly, is a mechanism that gives a benchmark level to the market. It says there's somebody out there already before you go into the auction who's ready to pay that amount. And that actually in many scenarios creates a lot of confidence. It creates actually a sense in the marketplace that that picture is already worth that because there is already a third party who will bid at that level.
Mm-hmm. And when do you know that you've done your job well as an auctioneer? Are you ever certain of it? Is there a time where you just bring the gavel down? You know, I did this exactly right.
Oh, I see. Well, no, but look, there's the whole auction and then there's the individual lots. And some lots are great successes. I mean, look at the Mary Cassatt. I mean, made over $4 million against an estimate of $700,000 to $1 million. I mean, that was an extraordinary result and the owner must be delighted, although I don't know them personally, but I mean, it's a great result. So you can have, within an auction, you can have lots that fly away. The Tamayo was a great success. And then you can have other ones where you think, oh, well, that was a bit disappointing, or that was a shame, and I thought that could have made more. So there's the individual scenarios about each lot. And then there's the whole auction in terms of, you know, how did it feel? You know, what was the take? What was the take home in terms of where does that leave people in their view of the market and the mood?
And in the end, it's the top line number. It's the whole auction that you
I think in the end, people look at the top line number for the total sales. They look at any records of which we, you know, any new prices, any benchmark prices that have been achieved against previous, you know, for instance, if you take the beautiful 1932 Picasso that we sold for $36.9 million, I think, that painting had been offered, I think, about in 2000, so 18 years ago. And at the time, it made around, I think, $7.9 million. We can come back and check that. But, you know, so the people will look at those as indicators of how a market has developed.
What is your goal in the end as an auctioneer? Is it just to sell the most valuable painting that's ever been sold? What's the North Star for someone in your line of work?
Oh, no. Well, look, I've already sold a work for $157.2 million. So that may not happen again very soon. But my goal is really to deliver the best results for our consigners and to bring well-curated and interesting auctions to the marketplace, which excite our global buyers, which bring in more buyers, which actually are interesting in terms of their quality, in terms of the material, the rarity of the works, the freshness of the works of the market. I mean, that's something about my job that I really love, is actually the curating of the auctions and bringing it together. Because after all, you know, these are not exhibitions like you might mount in a public museum. They are curated sales of works that are to be brought to market. And yet, when it all comes together, you get this sense of an exhibition, and that's tremendously exciting.
Is there one painting out there that you dream of selling?
Oh, yes, but I'm not going to tell that to you. I have my wish list.
It's been wonderful talking.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Working. I'm Jordan Weissman, and I want to say I appreciate you joining us this week. If you enjoyed the episode, please, please, please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. And if you have any thoughts, impressions, criticisms you want to share, requests, please email us at working@slate.com. Again, working@slate.com. My producer on this show and basically the maestro behind the whole thing is Jessamine Molly. I would like to give a big thank you to Justin D. Wright for our ad music, and I hope you'll join us next week.